So I changed my talk a little bit from what was advertised as a result of this morning's discussion to try to focus a little bit on some of the issues that came up in this morning. Now, one of those issues that came up was not just about integrating out degrees of freedom and renormalization group and so on, but it was about the importance of experiment. And so what I thought I'd do is I'd do an experiment right now for you, with your participation, to start off my talk. So everybody get out a finger, like this, okay? And I want you to do this experiment here. You're going to aim it at that wall, and you're going to push your finger like that, and let's see what happens. Everybody doing it right? Poor experimental technique over there and over there, Professor Kadanoff, but everybody else is more or less doing it just right in the right direction. Anybody feel the wall pushing back? Anything happening? Okay, now I'm going to do the same experiment. I'm going to repeat it. So here's what's going to happen this time. It fell over. Okay? Look at that. Let me just repeat it again. Yves Coudert had slow motion photography to help him, but I don't. So I want you to look very carefully. I'm pushing, and this thing is going to fall over. Okay? So what's the important message here? The important message is that I was able to transmit a force. I was able to transmit a force by pushing with my finger, and I was able to push the chair over. You guys, you were pushing with your fingers, and even those of you close to the wall, you didn't succeed in pushing the wall or making a dent or feeling anything pushing back. So here's the question, why not? What's different? And this is really a big puzzle. And it's a big puzzle because let's think about what the two experiments were that we just did. You did one experiment, I did another experiment. Now, the experiment that I did was in a solid, and the experiment that you did was in a liquid or a gas. And let's just think about what those things are. So we're talking about atoms that are in a box. They're just a bunch of atoms bouncing around inside the box, and they form a fluid state, and that's where you were pushing in with your fingers. At low temperatures, you form a solid, let's say a crystalline solid, but it doesn't have to be a crystalline solid. And when we did that, we found that we had new properties. There was a periodic crystal lattice, if you did it with a crystalline solid. And in particular, you had some sort of static shear rigidity. And it was the rigidity that made me able to transmit a force and be able to push over the chair, whereas you couldn't push through the fluid. So why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting because the underlying physics of the solid, the underlying physics of my chair that I just pushed over, is exactly the same as the air that you were pushing through with your fingers. Okay, the total energy of the system is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. The Hamiltonian of the system is the same, and lowering the temperature hasn't changed, in general, the interactions between the atoms, so you've got the same Hamiltonian, but you've got a different outcome. That's surprising. That's the thing that people were talking about this morning. So although the pairwise interactions between atoms didn't change much, the correlations between them changed, and what changed with that? Well, they changed because we lowered the temperature. We changed something that governs the statistical properties of the system. So the solid state was something that emerged as if by magic out of the fluid state. We didn't change the Hamiltonian, we just changed KT. So that's the phenomenon of emergence. Now, what's interesting about it? Why do we care? Why do we make such a big deal about it? Why do I teach a course at the University of Illinois called Emergent States of Matter? Well, the point about it is that even though the underlying Hamiltonian is the same for the fluid and the solid, we all know that that's not the most useful way to think about the problem. If you go and do a solid-state physics course, you'll say do Ashcroft and Mermin, and you'll start off with a model of a crystal with atoms localized at lattice sites with springs between them, and you'll work out the phonon modes of the atoms in the crystal, and that will be how you talk about solids. Nobody ever tells you that the same Hamiltonian is applying for the fluid and for the solid. So, in other words, what we're saying is that this solid state, the crystalline state, has its own new laws of physics. It's got new long-range forces that are completely different from the original forces that you had between the atoms. Those forces are the springs between the atoms in the solid, in the Ashcroft and Mermin picture of what a crystal is, and those springs give you the elasticity theory that we also heard about this morning. So the response of the solid to external disturbances completely changes, completely different from that of the fluid. That's the new long-range forces. And the origin of these new laws, it came from the KT that was in the e to the minus h over kbt, the partition function of the system. So these are new laws, they're collective, and they come from the statistical properties, the statistical behavior of the atoms. So does it really have its own new laws of physics? Is it really a good use of terminology to say the solid state has its own new laws of physics? Really? Well, I would say yes. And the reason is because if you work at the level of a description of the solid, then the actual interactions between the atoms can't be detected. So let's suppose you just are looking at solids and you're measuring their properties. You're doing elasticity theory, maybe you're doing X-ray scattering or something like this. You're looking at the shear rigidity. You can't deduce from that property, those properties of the system, the properties of the system at the solid state, what the underlying actual interactions were between the original degrees of freedom, the atoms. All you can observe is the continuum mechanics, the elasticity theory. So that's the sense in which we talk about it being new laws of physics emerging at the level of the solid, and that's why it takes so long for the existence of atoms to be deduced, because that works so well, it's such a self-consistent way of viewing the world, that it makes it harder to drill down to find out where do these things come from. So, where do atoms and their interactions matter? I mean, do we actually care that the world is made up of atoms? Well, we do, because the elastic forces are characterized by the phenomenological parameters, such as shear modulus and the Lame coefficients and so on and so forth, and we can only find out what values they have by going to a lower level of description, by doing a computer simulation or by doing an experiment, by measuring them. So we have to have in order to understand those parameters, we need to go to a lower level. Those phenomenological parameters are the residue, the inescapable residue of those lower level degrees of freedom. So we're used to this all the time. This is nothing new. When we do atomic physics or chemistry, when was the last time you ever needed to worry about the radiative corrections to the mass of the top quark? Never. No. You never worry about those things. Those are just all folded in to some of the parameters in the theory, say the mass of the proton or something like this. So here's what I want to say then, to summarize about emergence. Emergent levels of description absorb the properties of lower levels of description into phenomenological parameters, which hopefully is going to be a small number of smaller parameters, but not necessarily. And this is what makes doing fundamental physics, more precisely high energy physics, it makes it hard, because one goes against the flow of emergence. You start off with some microscopic level of description. As you go to the larger scale, the system tends to flow towards a universal description, like the elasticity theory of a solid. And so there's a many-to-one relationship as you go from the small to the large. And so when you're going the opposite way around, you've got to try to distinguish between the many possible microscopic theories that are consistent with a macroscopic theory that you are normally familiar with. So that's why reductionism is a hard thing to do. But the collective properties of matter can be understood and should be understood without requiring knowledge all the way down. So what I've told you is that when we talk about emergence, emergence is associated with a loss of uniqueness. Okay, it's not like, well, you just do something and this is what's left. I think of emergence as being the fact that you have non-mandatory states of the system. What I mean by that is, if you're at a high temperature, there's only one phase of the system, the fluid phase. If you're at low temperatures, you have the emergence of a solid state phase. Okay, it's a loss of uniqueness. So then, as we all know, phase transitions separate those states, and the new collective properties arise in those emergent states. So that's, as an introduction, that's how I and many of us tend to view emergence, somewhat different from the way that it was discussed this morning when we were talking about effective field theories. Now, emergent properties, of course, are very commonplace in solid-state physics, maybe in other aspects of life. What I would like to do in the remaining part of my time is I want to go through an example of effective theories, which is not the usual phase transition, critical renormalization group story that you've heard already today, I want to tell you about something that most of you probably haven't heard about, which is the application of these ideas in, for example, numerical analysis, and in solving, in my case in particular, looking at the kinetics of phase transitions, looking at the dynamics of spatially extended systems. So this is a residue from a previous talk that I'd given, which was about complexity, and I think I'm going to just skip over those for now. Okay, so I want to now just talk about minimal models and universality, because we heard the terms this morning, and I want to talk about that. So let's now talk about polymers. So polymers are very important molecules, and I wanted to show you different ways that people tend to view them. So one way that people tend to view them is like this. This is a chemist's view of a polymer, and it's a bunch of atoms strung together in some particular way, like that. This is a computational biologist's view of a polymer. So this might be Klaus Schulzen at the University of Illinois. He's a computational biologist. He studies protein folding and so on and so forth. And so here you've got some atoms, then you've got some helices and beta sheets and so on. That's a biophysicist or computational biophysicist's view of a polymer. Here's a theoretical physicist's view of a polymer. Okay, so a theoretical physicist views a polymer as basically matter that's made up of just long stringy objects. Okay, we don't care too much about what the atoms are. We can't even pronounce the names of these molecules. But what we are interested in are different questions than these other people. Now, the chemist is interested in understanding chemical bonding and reactions, binding sites, and so on. And so this level of description is the appropriate one. Someone who's like a computational biophysicist would be interested in elasticity, large-scale motions, protein folding, and so on. And the physicist, the theoretical physicist in particular, is interested in asking the following question. What large-scale properties of the system follow just from the fact that it's made out of long stringy objects as opposed to round blobby objects like normal atoms? That's the sort of question that we're interested in. Is there anything generic that follows from that? Well, the answer is that there is. So let me give you an example, and then I'll show you some experimental data. So let's ask the following question. How would you answer the question of how big is a polymer? So how would you answer that question? So the polymer in question is going to have monomers of length little l, and there's going to be n of them. So the total arc length of the polymer, the arc length this is, not the total length, is l. What we're interested in is the size, the radius of gyration, the sort of the size of the polymer. So here's the way that a chemist might try to understand that question. The chemist would say, this is great. All we have to do is model all the bond angles, measure all the energy barriers to the rotational states, work out the interactions with the solvent molecules. Then we're going to put that into a big computer, sample over long times or many independent configurations. And at the end of the day, you've done a calculation, and you can predict R in angstroms. Okay, so that's what you can do, and people actually do that. Here's the physicist's way of doing it. So the physicist says, well, wait a minute, this thing is just a random walk with n steps, each of length little l. So we know from Einstein that what's going to happen is that if I have a random walk, RMS, the mean square end-to-end distance is going to go like n, the number of steps, times the monomer length squared. So it's going to go as n, not n squared. And so that's the physicist's answer. And the physicist is happy with that. And then you point out that actually, first of all, this answer isn't as good as the chemist's, because the chemist said, here's the answer in angstroms, and all the physicists have said, R squared equals little l times big L. Okay, what use is that to anyone? It's not even so useful. Something's happened here. It's not even so useful. Not as useful as the chemist one, and even worse, it's completely wrong. Okay, it's wrong because this model, this Einstein model, is ignoring the fact that polymers can't cross itself. Two atoms can't occupy the same position in space. If you go and take that into account in a very generic way, using the normalization group theory and so on and so forth, as people have done about 20 years ago, starting from Degen and Edwards and others, what you learn is that, in fact, the RMS distance scales not as the square root of L, but as L to this power here. So this scaling is something that we know is universal. It's absolutely independent of the chemical structure. It doesn't matter whether it's polymethyl methacrylate or DNA or polyethylene, doesn't really matter. You're still going to get this scaling as long as you can access this asymptotic limit, and you just simply can't predict the size in angstroms. Physicists are really crap at doing that. I mean, it's just no good at all. We can't do that, but we can predict the scaling law. Here's another thing that we can do. So this is a calculation that was done by my colleague Yoshi Ono and Takao Oto in the 1980s, and then measured by Pierre Wiltiets and et al. A little bit later. So what they worked out was they took this picture, comes from the normalization group, of taking a microscopic model of polymers in a solvent, and then coarse graining, doing the mumbo jumbo that people know how to do. And here's what they predicted. They said, here's the thing you do. You take the osmotic pressure, you divide it by the concentration over kT, and you plot it against the concentration normalized by a quantity C star, which they told you how to compute. And then they said that quantity, if you go and calculate the osmotic pressure for different concentrations and different molecular weights, they will all fall onto one universal curve, independent of anything, just by virtue of the stringy nature of polymers. And here you are. Here's the universal curve that they computed using epsilon expansions and various other technical methods to get some approximation for it. Here's the experimental data. And one thing you'll notice is, first of all, that the theorists came up with a definite prediction this time. Okay, and it's a functional form. There's no adjustable parameters, and there's no material-specific parameters, and the data all lie within the experimental error very close to this curve. So that's the sort of universality that I think is what we should be looking for. This is an example of a minimal model. It's a spaghetti model. It looks nothing like the real world. It's got a caricature of the real world embedded in it, namely that you've got some flexible random walk that can't cross itself. It's very good for answering certain sorts of questions. The universal scaling laws of the osmotic pressure as a function of concentration, it's terrible at answering other questions, like what is the size of the polymer. So if you're going to use emergent effective theories and all of this, you have to be using them to ask the right questions. So scientific predictions, I would say, are always the result of minimal models. Why? Well, obviously, you can't include every detail in a model. So in physics, you can usually get away with that. There's only a few details that might be important. Separation of energy scales is possible, so you can make maybe some minimal models of pretty much everything we do in physics. In fact, you can almost define physics by saying it's the field where doing this strategy of making minimal models is successful. We're only successful because we ask very simple questions, not because we're any cleverer than biologists or anything like this. So in physics, it's only possible because of this separation of scales and the fact that this method works. In chemistry, you usually do need a lot of details at the atomic level, but you don't really need to worry about quarks and so on. I classify those problems as hard. There's other fields where, who knows? This whole program is not mandatory. There's nothing that says the world has to work this way. So in economics, or maybe biology, it seems there's no obvious separation of scales. It's not obvious that one can do this program. Okay, so that's the propaganda. So now I want to talk about some experiments. So I want to now talk about some condensed matter problems, one in particular, which people were studying a lot in the 1980s and 1990s. I was doing this, and Leo and many other people around the world, Yves Couder, many of us were trying to work on these problems of trying to understand complex patterns. And the question is, can we model materials microstructure realistically using minimal models? So if you look at the metal in this room, any piece of metal under a microscope, what you're going to see is a mass of interlocked snowflakes, or more technically, dendrites. That's what these things are. That's what it's going to look like, and the structure of these determines the mechanical, the electrical, the thermal properties of most metals and alloys. So it's a very important question. It's also an interesting aesthetic question. So if you look at a metal under a microscope, this is what you see, this carpet of dendrites, and you see something like this. Now, I know, I'm pretty sure, maybe one exception, who's looking at his cell phone at the moment, that there are no material scientists in this room. Okay, how do I know that? I know that because nobody asked the question, what is the scale bar here? Okay, usually when you show a electron microscope picture, somebody says, well, what's the scale bar? And usually you show, you know, a little line along the bottom here, and it shows you that 1 micron. Nobody did that. Okay, well, why did you? Well, you were right not to ask, because who cares? Okay, the important thing is the pattern. You all know that this structure is microscopic, it's micron size, something like that. That's not the important question. The important question is the pattern, not the actual dimensions. So the question we're asking is the shapes, is that, can we understand that without having to understand everything? And the answer is yes. So let me explain to you a little bit about that. I'm not going to be able to tell you everything about this. There's a whole massive set of talks I could give you on this, but I just wanted to just give you... Is there something here? There's supposed to be a green blob there. Good, okay. Good, okay. So if you want to understand the patterns that you see in nature, you have to solve differential equations. If you solve differential equations, well, what do you have to do? I'm not going to write down the differential equations, but you have to go and do something like numerical analysis. So you go and look in a numerical analysis book, and here's what you'll find. You'll say, take the differential equation, take all the derivatives, express them as finite differences using Taylor expansions and so on. Then you will get a set of discrete equations on every node of a lattice, and then you try to propagate all those nodes on the lattice forward in time, and that's how you solve a differential equation on a computer. And if you want to simulate something that is in a continuum, well, then you better make sure that you do this, and then you make the grid smaller and smaller and smaller, and you make sure that your numerics is grid converged. You make sure that you've really solved the differential equation you thought you were doing. And if you try to send in a paper to, say, a Journal of Fluid Mechanics or something like that, and you haven't gone and painstakingly studied and shown that you can extract the continuum limit, you won't be able to get your paper published. But here's a dirty little secret that everybody knows, whoever has done a numerical simulation, which is that if you go and take your set of maps, and you say, I can't be bothered to take dx all the way to zero and extrapolate and do all that carefully, I'm going to just make dx something big, okay? That way it's a lot cheaper. Actually, when you go and do that, and you run the solutions, they actually look just as good as the things that you're going to get many months later after a lot more work. It actually works without having to take the continuum limit, in some cases. Okay? There's other cases, of course, where that continuum limit is very subtle and there's bifurcations and things, and you really have to worry about those. So the question is, are the lattice and the continuum model in the same universality class? If they are, then maybe we don't have to require grid convergence. Maybe we can just get away by doing what somebody would call sloppy numerics. You'd never get your paper published in Journal of Fluid Mechanics, but maybe you're still getting the right answer. And maybe you can still get correct results from your calculations. So let me give you an example. I've got, 5 minutes left? Okay, so here's the conventional approach to solving differential equations. Take nature. Model it as a partial differential equation. Look at the equation and say, heck, I can't solve that. Stick it on a computer. So now you go and discretize the partial differential equation. Then you get a bunch of coupled maps on the lattice that you have to solve. Then you compute. Then you find you've got the wrong answer. And why did you get the wrong answer? Well, because your discretization introduced a whole bunch of secondary instabilities that had nothing to do with nature, and you have to sort of really try to work hard to get them away. Well, why don't we just cut out the middleman? Why not just model nature as coupled maps straight away? Model it in a way so that even if you have a large dx, dt, the map is still topologically the same map that you would get if you had the continuum limit. So let me show you some examples of that. One example, that's all I've got time for. So this is the problem. I'm not going to have time to go through this in detail, but this is the problem of what's going to happen to you tonight when you go to dinner and you go and order a salad, let's say, in a restaurant, and you have some oil and vinaigrette dressing on your salad. So you're sitting there, you've poured the oil and vinegar on your lettuce, you're talking with your dinner companion, and then after a couple of minutes, you look down, you pay attention to your salad, and you discover that you've got an unappetizing mess of globules sitting on your plate. Okay, what's happened is you've had phase separation. What's happened is you started off with your oil and vinegar This is the concentration of oil along this axis. This is the temperature up the vertical axis. You started off when they were nicely mixed. You've basically now at a temperature where there's two phase coexistence. And if you sit at this point in the phase diagram long enough, you're going to get two coexisting phases, an oil-rich phase and a vinegar-rich phase. And those things coalesce. Those things form droplets that coalesce and eventually lead to complete phase separation. So you describe that by saying there's a free energy density that has got two minima, and then if you go and simulate that, you will see a pattern that looks like this, where orange is oil and blue is vinegar. I'm not going to go through the scale invariance properties of that. They're very interesting, but let's not worry about it. Now, here's a way that you can simulate this sort of problem, and this is an approach due initially to Yoshi Ono. And what he said was the following. Let's imagine we're looking at that process. Let's divide our system up into little cells. They're not microscopic. They're not infinitesimal. They're macroscopic of order the correlation length in the system. Let's look at the dynamics of each cell. We want the dynamics of each cell to have two minima, because the dynamics of each cell is telling you the concentrations in that cell. So if you look at the dynamics in this double well potential, you've got two minima, one here, and then you've got an unstable point here, and if you start here, you'll roll down into this minimum. So if you look at the dynamics, you can see that what you've got is a fixed point here, another fixed point here. This fixed point is a repeller. This fixed point is an attractor. So then the idea is, well, we don't care about the details of this potential, because after all, it wasn't given to us by God in any case. We just wrote it down as some Carnot-Hilliard free energy or something like this. So we'll just choose any map you like that has this fixed point structure. That will be our dynamics for each cell. Okay, now, couple the cells together. So what you're going to do is you're going to say, I'm going to write down an equation of motion for the concentration at each time step. And then what you're going to do is this is a map. Then what you're going to do is you're going to couple the cells. So what you're going to do is you're going to say, well, each cell sees its nearest neighbor. And to see its nearest neighbor, what that means is that what happens is matter diffuses from one cell to the next. So that means what diffusion is the following. If I'm got more concentration than your neighbor, then I go down. If my neighbor has more concentration than me, it goes down. That's all diffusion is. So I just look around and just measure my concentration. That gives me the coupling between the cells. And then as a last step, I'll make sure that I don't add or subtract any atoms to the system. So this is a discrete coupled map lattice description, no continuum limit, dt and dx are order one, and it's not a naive discretization of the partial differential equation that you would normally have written down. Okay, now, the algorithm models the same physics as the partial differential equation. This algorithm here, this is a five-line computer program. You can all write this down as a computer program, it's five lines. My claim is that's the same thing as the partial differential equation. They're both in the same universality class as the physical process. And so it should give you the same results. So here, let me show you how it works. This is an example of what happens if you take not oil and vinegar, but a liquid crystal, like in your iPad display or something like this, and you lower the temperature. What happens is the molecules are initially pointing all at random, and as you lower the temperature, they all start to line up. That's called the isotropic, for pointing all at random, to a pneumatic transition, pneumatic meaning all pointing in the same direction. Actually, pneumatic means something different from that, but the effect is that they point in the same direction. You get topological defects in such a system. You get the analogs of monopoles, which are the textures of the orientation fields of the liquid crystals. They look like, when you look at them through cross-polarizers, they look like this. You see these kind of bow tie-like structures here. That's a monopole, that's another monopole, that's another monopole. As you go through the transition, you make many of these monopoles. These monopoles move around, and they collide, and they annihilate. And so as you go from time to different time, short times to long times, you can see that there's less monopoles present. Now that's not an experimental picture, it's a simulation. Here's an experimental picture. So this is the experimental data. This was from a paper by Nagaya et al. In 1995. And you can see that in this movie here, of 32 seconds, you can see a very rapid evolution of the pattern, a very complex spatial-temporal pattern, many less topological defects here in this state of 32 seconds than there were initially. Okay, so you say that's good. That picture and this picture from the simulations, they look very close. So it looks like the simulation technology worked. Five-line computer program there, real experiment here. But how about anything quantitative? Well, when we did those calculations originally, what we did was we discovered that if I measure the probability of having a monopole here and another monopole here, and I work out that probability distribution as a function of space and time, it can be written down into a scaled function, which I've written. I'm not going to go through how we did it, and the data are these black squares here. That's what we predicted from our five-line computer program. When Nagaya et al. Went and did their experiment, that's these cloud of data points here. They scaled the data in just the way that we prescribed, and lo and behold, it has the same functional form. It does collapse. These are data for different times and different space. They all collapse onto one universal curve. Okay? And then later on, one of my students, Fong Liu and Jean Mazenko at the University of Chicago, worked out an analytical theory of this, a sort of extended mean field theory, that does a very good job of describing this. So you've got, even though you've not grid-converged your numerics, even though you can never publish this in the Journal of Fluid Mechanics, the minimal model still correctly captured the most important features of the data. The data collapse was predicted by the theory, and the experiment agrees with simulation with no adjustable parameters. So that's great. If you say, on the other hand, okay, tell me at 32 seconds how far apart are two monopoles, well, I haven't a clue. Okay? If you just give me one number at the beginning of the simulation to compare my simulation with the experiment, then I could make that prediction for you. But I don't care. I want to just compute the correlation function. Hang on, I'm going to run out of time in just a second, so I'm going to finish with my summary. So all I've shown you is that predictions can rely on the existence of minimal models, and you can make parameter-independent universal quantities. This is more than just making pretty pictures. Simple computer programs, like cellular automata, for example, or these cell dynamical systems models, they don't just produce pretty pictures, they can actually produce parameter-free predictions. Computational algorithms can model very simple processes, generate complicated space-time structures. And you can quantitatively predict universal quantities, universal scaling functions, not just fractal dimensions and so on, with ease. I'm going to skip another talk and just put up just some further reading. Okay, that's all I wanted to say, so thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. One thing I've learned is never to send an article to the Journal of Fluid Mechanics.
I didn't check if there were any editors in the room, but
sorry,
I'm not going to tell you.
I have a question that should take you 10 seconds to answer, and then I have a real question.
Okay.
So the 5 seconds.
You're going to soften me up and then lull me into a full sense of.
The 10 second question is the one I raised my hand at near the end of your talk.
Yeah.
Could we see the figure again?
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's the agreement between theory and experiment.
If anybody wants to ask me about biology, I'll be happy to say.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah. Okay, so look, naively, I would say that if you took away that curve and the black squares, it's not obvious that there's any theory. I mean, the data's all over the map.
No. If you take the raw data look nothing like this. These are curves that fill a plane. There are different spaces and different times. So there's one curve for time 4 seconds, one curve for time 8 seconds, one for 12, 16, 24. So these are curves, boom, 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 like this. There's no reason for them to collapse in the way that they do. This is data collapse I'm showing. I'm not.
I guess I can't see the data collapsing. It just looks.
You can't see the data collapsing because I'm not showing you the raw data. I'm only showing you the result of the data collapse.
I see a very large spread in points. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing.
Yeah, you're focusing on the wrong thing. Yes, there's noise in these data points. Is that what you're asking? There's a cloud. The point is this: the raw data is a curve like this, a curve like this, a curve like this, a curve like this. Different functional forms for different, as a function of R for different times. And the data are collapsed.
So maybe I'm stupid, but if I just look at, say, the cross.
This is the easy question or the hard one?
This is the easy one. If I just look at the crosses,
yes.
If you take away everything but the crosses,
yeah.
I don't see them lying on a curve.
Well, they didn't. They're not up here. I don't see any up here.
No,
I only see them.
Come on, look
I only
at the crosses.
See them around
no,
here.
They're not. Look at where they are. They're all over the place.
Okay. The pluses. No, well, okay.
Crosses.
Well, anyway.
Diagonal crosses.
That is the. That's
16
the.
16 seconds.
Anyway, the authors of the paper considered this agreement.
Okay, fine.
And emergent scaling curve or not?
Anyway.
Something's emerging.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, I can show you simulation.
I captured most important features of the data.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps most important is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, I don't agree. I don't think that you would have known, certainly nobody before we did. First of all, the simulation was done several years before the experiments were done. And there's absolutely no reason to have believed that these data would give you this functional form for the scaling function.
Okay, can I,
so,
can I ask?
So I think we should go and duke it out afterwards.
Yeah.
Remember, I've got the hockey stick.
Can I ask the serious question?
Yes.
So you stated near the end of your talk that what was typical in emergence and in effective field theories was that if one took a high energy theory, then you could have you could imagine a whole bunch of different high energy theories that would give the same low energy theory, but not the reverse. Okay.
Oh, yes. So you're talking about why it's difficult to sort of discern
yes.
the fundamental
Fine.
Laws of physics. Yeah.
Now, I want to query that.
Okay, go ahead.
So let's imagine that we have...
So have you figured out beyond standard model physics yet before you do that?
In this case, the question gets asked before the answer. So let's imagine that we have some well-defined set of atoms, let's say silicons and oxygens. And the high energy theory, you would agree, is basically one theory for all
glass.
These little atoms and so. No, high energy. It's
oh,
not glass.
Glass. High energy, yeah.
Yeah. Now, at low temperatures or lower temperatures, I'm going to ask the following question. Is there one and one only macroscopic description, which is what you're saying is going to be the low energy effective theory?
Well, well I'm not saying it's mandatory, but yeah.
So... and we can do this with your spaghetti as well, if you like, but just this is simpler. Well, let's imagine that we allow these things to condense out in a long glass thread, okay? Now, it's well known that if you do that, the properties of that long glass thread will be all over the map.
Sure.
In fact, if you take one glass thread and you leave it under tension for a couple of hours, its macroscopic properties will change totally, and the initial macroscopic properties I mean, the distribution is not Gaussian, it's incredibly wide. So
yeah.
How can you say then that there's only one low energy description under those circumstances?
I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm not saying that that's mandatory. So disordered systems that are out of thermal equilibrium, slow relaxation times, absolutely, I completely agree with you. In the theories that the people were talking about this morning, very simple, quantum field theories and so on, in most of those cases, people don't really have much doubt about what the low energy behavior is of a P-wave superfluid. So I think I wouldn't disagree with the way that the examples that they were proposing there. So I don't think anybody is saying that there is a universal panacea to every problem of a collective phenomenon. I'm certainly not, and you're certainly not, and I don't think...
So we agree.
Yes, I don't think so. I don't think there's a problem there.
Maybe just one comment on this plot. I mean, it would be
yes.
nice to see the independent residuals to this plot, because as long as they are randomly scattered, right, it might be noisy, but it's
no,
a good
no,
fit.
Yeah. I can show you... All right, well, I can show you another thing like this. But the best one I have of that is work I did in geophysics, where we actually did a direct comparison between solving a particular set of equations using a conventional Journal of Fluid Mechanics approved method and solving them by this sort of method. and then actually taking the raw data and then and then collapsing the data and showing that it worked extremely well. So I can show you an example where all potential sources of error due to experimental noise or just subjectivity of looking at a graph, where those are removed. But this is the best data I can show you that I know of.
But for the same reasons, you had a previous plot which looked like a parabola before.
Yes.
And there actually...
No, it's not a parabola. You mean the osmotic pressure? This one?
Yeah, stop back.
Yes.
I mean, but here it's clear. I mean, the independent residuals will be a very bad fit if you go to, on the right side.
Yes.
You see
here,
that there's a deviation.
Up here, the approximation method that was used, the epsilon expansion, they were able to do it to first or second order, I don't remember, and I don't remember if they did Borel summation or not. So that was that. So, you know, when we do these sorts of calculations in condensed matter physics, we're always trying to compute these things in some technical approximations. And we always know the limit of validity of those approximations. So the approximation is not an exact calculation. There will be an error. There will be an error when the approximation scheme is outside of its regime of validity. But again, you might say, well, you know, who knows if this thing is right. You look at the raw data. The raw data are curves that fill the plane. They've been collapsed onto a line that is a line. They've lowered the dimensionality. So this sort of data collapse is very significant. And in fact, in phase transition physics, it's extremely important for understanding, you know, the renormalization group and so on. It's not just can you calculate a critical exponent. You want to be able to compute functions. That's really the best way you have to be able to understand what's going on. Did I answer your question? Okay.
You showed a couple of examples of systems where you have start with the coarse grain model as opposed to, say, a continuum model that you then discretize and sort of want to make some argument about them giving equivalent predictions, at least in some regime, because
yeah,
they're in the same universality class. Do you have any sense of what the criteria might be for knowing, short of comparing to the actual data, that those two different models are in the same universality class,
so
other than just showing it works?
So physicists are always satisfied with levels and standards of proof that satisfy neither physicists, neither philosophers nor mathematicians. So so there's nothing that tells us that we have to model nature by using infinitesimal calculus. If we had never invented calculus, and we had computers for some miraculous reason, we'd be modeling data, we'd be modeling the world the way that I showed you. We'd say, well, you've got, you know, two states here, you've got some conservation law, blah, blah, blah. That's how you would write down the dynamics. You wouldn't even think of doing it the other way.
That's usually how we get the continuum limit to begin with.
Sorry?
I mean, that's typically how we get the continuum description to begin with, is we start with little boxes and then take the limit at the end. You're
well,
just sort of proposing a version
you don't,
where
you don't
take the
you
limit.
Don't have to write down a differential equation. And so I can give you another example. A very complicated example, a Baroque example that we worked out a couple of years ago, which was looking at trying to understand the patterns that form at in the geology of geothermal hot springs. So if you ever go to Yellowstone National Park, you'll see, if you go to Mammoth, that's 60 miles or so north of Old Faithful, you'll see these terraces, these beautiful cascading scale invariant terraces. And you might say, why does the landscape look like that? That's the first question that a child would ask. And the answer is, well, who knows? So we tried to model it. So, of course, there's no way you can model the complicated chemical deposition processes, the fluid flow, and so on, microscopically. So we went and made a model that was very in this spirit. It's too complicated to explain. It had all the same physical elements represented in the mathematics in a different way than you would in a differential equation. We were able to replicate the patterns. We were able to compare our simulation results with experimental data that we took, and it agreed again with no adjustable parameters. We were even able to, in some cases, where you found carbonate deposits that were in the shape of beautiful cylindrically symmetrical domes. We were even able to write down the differential equations that described it, solve those analytically and numerically, and compare them with what we got with our this way of doing things, and the result was perfect agreement. So you know, I can't tell you, I can prove some magical theorem that says you can always do this, or I can even give you a recipe. I'm just saying that as a physicist, as someone who models the world, you have to be flexible in how you do that, and for some situations, this approach is a very good one.
Well, I mean, maybe another way to ask the question is to make the observation that I did before, which is typically we get these continuum models by doing exactly what you're proposing, which is cutting the world up into little boxes, modeling the relationships between them, and then the magic of calculus is that for certain classes of things, you can actually take a limit, but it's really just code for the discrete model.
I don't agree that it's as simple as that, because you see, when you do those things, you make all sorts of assumptions that you hide under the rug. So let me give you one, okay? Because I don't think I agree with you about that. So you're always appealing to this, the same sort of universality that I'm appealing to, but except that you just don't notice it. So let's suppose you're modeling the salad dressing problem. Okay, so there what you do is you write down some free energy, so you're going to say, well, I've got to have a double well potential, so I have some R phi squared, then I have some U phi to the fourth, then I have some gradient term. And then I integrate this over the whole system. And that's my free energy, my double well free energy. Then I write down the chemical potential as the df by d phi. And so I write down the current as some mobility times the gradient of df by d phi. And then I say the concentration is conserved. So I write down d phi by dt plus div j is equal to 0. And that gives me the Kahn-Hilliard equation, which is del squared of df by d phi, and that's the theory. Okay, that's the continuum theory, except that where did this come from? You made some model there. You just said, well, it's going to have some two minima, so it doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether this is a log cosh function or some other function or just this. So even when you're doing your continuum modeling, you are usually, without drawing attention to it, putting in the same sort of assumptions that I'm putting in, but I'm drawing attention to them in this more discrete modeling. That's how I'd answer your question. So I think they're the same thing.
Okay, Leo, you had your hand up.
There's another way of dealing with this. One can look at simplified problems in which you begin to know answers from a multiplicity of techniques. For example, I've spent an inordinate amount of my time working on the two-dimensional Ising model. In the two-dimensional Ising model, we have a classification of behaviors based upon the structure of what happens at small scales and a theory that attempts to describe what happens in small scales as affecting what happens in large. The theory is Wilsonian renormalization. The analysis of small scales can be made exact in the context of the Ansager theory, and you can analyze all the different kinds of behaviors at small scales. The result gives you the same answers as you get from the Ansager exact solution, that there are two parameters which determine what happens, magnetic field and T minus TC. And all the other parameters that you might put into the problem are irrelevant. Irrelevant not in the sense that you might think they're not important. Irrelevant in the sense that they renormalize to zero in a well-defined way as you take the system up to its largest, up to large scales. There is then a fully consistent, intellectually backed theory which gives you the answers for that situation, and indeed there are experiments which further support those answers. It is as unlikely that the theory of the two-dimensional Ising model, as I've just outlined it, is wrong as that the theory of quantum electrodynamics is wrong.
Yeah, I'm going to change the tone a little bit because we're going into general discussions. So you're still on the hot seat, but so is Eve, if Eve is here. So I want to use Eve's phenomenon to raise again an issue about the meaning of emergent phenomena, because I think that Eve's phenomena is clearly emergent, as is the properties of steel and many of the other things we've been discussing. But I want to try out, and you'll all tell me why I'm wrong, a different definition for what an emergent phenomenon is. So because I keep hearing novel, and novel is very puzzling, because is it surprising to Leo? Maybe it's not surprising to Leo, but would be surprising to me. There's a straightforward notion that we can mean by novel, which is occurs in the universe for the first time. So I would say that Eve's phenomenon probably doesn't occur naturally, and therefore is occurring in the universe for the first time, and therefore is by that definition an emergent phenomenon, because it was not present before, it was therefore made to emerge by a smart group of experimentalists. And similarly, steel never existed before it was made, and therefore emerged. Well, I don't know my geology, but let me just finish. And biology is then, you know, the paramount example of an emergent phenomenon, because clearly there was a time before there was any biology. So is that a definition that helps resolve the problem of whether something is which is emergent is subjective?
They might not exist in the universe, or they may exist for the first time, but you might still be able to predict them before you found out that they existed. And what you typically take as emergent is something that can't be predicted from the microphysics.
Okay, so then I may be the only person in the room who's confused by this criteria of could not possibly have predicted, because...
I think that that's a complete red herring, this complete, you know, could not be predicted.
But philosophers in the room are holding forth to it, so I think we have a confusion or a disagreement. Can you unpack what you mean by could
yes,
not possibly
let me run back here. I think what's important is that the outcome, the state of the system is not the system is bistable, multistable. There are many possible states of the system that it could have. It could either be a fluid state, or it could be a solid state below a certain temperature. Above a certain temperature, there's only one state of the system. I think it's that transition between one state and multi-states, multi-stable. That's what emergence is. When you get a new state, it's not a question of whether it ever existed before or whether we're smart enough to see it from the equations or not. I think that's what it means to the everyday physicist in the street who's just trying to solve her equations. That's what it means to us, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's just a difference about what I think it from the philosophical point of view, that allows way too many things in to count as emergence, because you how do you make a distinction between something like an emergent property and something like just a plain aggregate,
Here's the answer. New collective properties arise in emergent systems. When you go below the magnetization transition, you get emergent spin wave stiffness. You can support spin waves, or in a solid, you can support shear waves, a shear modulus. You don't have that above it. So there's a physical property, it's a collective property of the entire system that wasn't there before for reasons associated with the collective behavior of the underlying degrees of freedom. That's what emergence is.
Right, but then I don't understand why you think prediction is a red herring. Because you can't predict those states
That's not true. You can predict them. We predict them all the time. It's not a true statement. When we understand superconductivity, it's not like, wow, that's a big surprise. We didn't know how to write down the BCS wave function until 1957 and so on and so forth. That doesn't mean people didn't understand, that's when we understood the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, but it's not that it couldn't be predicted. We were just, you know, too stupid to think of the wave function. I mean, there's no question of principle, it's a calculation. Now, it's a graduate student exercise.
Well, I don't want to go on at this, but...
Just like surprise.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't agree. I think if you've heard that we can't predict these things, that's not true.
I think there is a missing clause there, predict from something. So I think the claim wasn't that we can't predict or understand these phenomena, but that they can't be predicted from some underlying theory. Is that right?
Well, you can't predict it from the wrong theory, that's for sure.
We're not predicting it from the underlying theory. That's a major portion of our living.
Yeah, we do it all the time.
Theories.
Actually, we can't predict TC theories, very well.
You've been given those theories by experiment. If you had started with the n particle collection of electrons, you would not.
I don't agree with you as a matter of historical fact. We still can't predict TC.
Yeah,
very
I don't agree with you. And I got a microphone. So you can listen.
We can't there are some things that we can't predict and some things that we can predict very well. And
listen. I don't think it's fair to say that superconductivity was not a surprise when it was first observed, right?
Of course, it was a surprise when yeah.
So I would say that is emergent, because even if I had known the laws of quantum mechanics, I would not have anticipated superconductivity.
Do you think, say, that knowing the temperature dependence of the thermal conductivity of yttrium-barium copper oxide below 1 degree is an emergent phenomenon?
Okay.
Of course it's not. Nobody knew what it was until it was measured.
Tell me what we're going to find next.
I don't.
Okay, but I do
it in my day job. For some little problems, I am able to predict what you're going to see next. Not for everything.
But I mean, a simple. So I sympathize with Nigel that the predictability is not the point. So for instance, phonons are emergent, right? They are collective motions,
yeah.
But
yes,
they are perfectly
yeah.
predictable, they're not very difficult to predict.
Yep. Yep.
They're not very surprising, but they're emergent nonetheless.
they're consequences of the emergence of a spring constant, which is itself an emergent phenomenon. Nothing difficult about it. Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe the philosophical worry is that this definition of emergence, it's not clear exactly what it excludes. I mean, if emergent macro properties are commonplace, can you give some examples of macro properties which are not emergent? Or is every collective property of a system going to be an emergent property? Just one piece of background.
No, not every property is. Remember the experiment that you guys did at the beginning. So I made you do this one, okay? I made you poke the air, and the air didn't fight back. There was no emergent property. There was no emergent rigidity of the air. However, when I pushed the chair over, the chair was a solid and it fought back, and I was able to transmit a force and push it over. That was the difference between something which they both have collective properties. After all, I can write down the equations of fluid mechanics and make sound waves and so on and so forth, but it doesn't have an emergent rigidity, not until you go below 0 degrees
It doesn't have emergent rigidity because it doesn't have the property of rigidity.
Yes.
So what I was looking for was an example of a macro property that is distinct from the micro level but not emergent. I'm wondering if they're all emergent, because traditionally the notion of emergence has functioned to have a distinction between emergent properties and merely resultant or aggregative properties.
Contained within the atoms and are not new in the process of addition. Is that the sort of thing you want to talk about?
I'm wondering if there are any macro properties in the macro system that fail to be emergent.
Mass.
Yes, mass.
Just a process of addition.
Just the additive properties then aren't emergent and everything else is.
You can almost defy.
You can. How good you are in mathematics. If you're good at math, other things are equally obvious. And if you're not a good at math, maybe addition is the only thing.
Okay, thank you.
So, going back to Hamas' remark about...
The last question. So I don't know who's going to put their hand up next. 5 o'clock, time for submergence.
So do I continue?
So
when Einstein introduced the idea of phonon, it must have been a great surprise. because there was specific heat which showed anomalous behavior at low temperature, a strong deviation from classical physics. So he was forced to introduce harmonic oscillators living in a solid.
Actually, he did it wrong, didn't he?
Whatever it is, but you know, but the very idea of introducing some elementary oscillators to describe low-temperature thermal phenomena was, and it was another point, guided by experiment. In fact, often we theorists are very, very powerless. You know, we are, because there are so many things going on.
Yes.
So we are pushed to corners by experiments, like cuprate superconductivity.
Yes, yes.
Hubbard model has been with us for a long time.
Yeah.
But nobody had an inclination to think about superconductivity in that context. So cuprates, in the form of experimental results, pushed people to think about it. So repeatedly, experiments play a very, very important role.
Yes.
And surprises are from that point of view also.
So let me make two answers to your question. So the first thing, I interjected about Einstein because the example was a very interesting one. His idea of the heat capacity said, let's consider each atom and let it just oscillate about its mean position.
Sure.
And that was wrong. That gave you the wrong temperature dependence. Hang on, wait, let me finish my answer. then Debye realized, wait, you've got to cook these things up by springs because that's the property of a solid, the emergent property of a solid. Then you get the sound waves, the phonons, and then you get the right answer.
But I will forgive Einstein for his.
I forgive Einstein for it too, because he made up for it later. But that distinction is an important one. It shows you that the practicality and the importance of really recognizing emergent phenomena and collective phenomena for what they are. You can't describe everything you want to describe in nature as additive. So that was my first comment. And the second part of the question was...
But experiments
Yes. I think, in fact, it follows up the question that Leo asked Eve at the seminar, which is, if you can do the computer simulations, why bother to do the experiment? I actually had a grant proposal turned down because I was doing computer simulations, my colleague was doing experiments, and the reviewer said, why bother to do the experiments when Goldenfeld can do the computer simulations? The point is that experiment is our almost unique way of making discoveries. Okay, it's much, much better for making discoveries than computer simulation is. And that's why we do experiment. I mean, people do make discoveries with computer simulation. We discovered long-time tails through that and so on. But by and large, that's why we do experiment, because what we're really paid to do is make discoveries.
Yep, they've seen the Higgs and computer experiments, for example, right? Trying to do real experiments is more difficult. All right, so let's thank Nigel and Eve.